Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. May Day, Chapter 10. Mr. In and Mr. Out are not listed by the census taker. You will search for them in vain through the social register, or the births, marriages, and deaths, or the grocer's credit list. Oblivion has swallowed them, and the testimony that they ever existed at all is vague and shadowy, and inadmissible in a court of law. Yet I have it upon the best authority that for a brief space Mr. In and Mr. Out lived, breathed, answered to their names, and radiated vivid personalities of their own. During the brief span of their lives, they walked in their native garments down the great highway of a great nation, were laughed at, sworn at, chased, and fled from. Then they passed and were heard of no more. They were already taking form dimly when a taxi cab with the top open breezed down Broadway in the faintest glimmer of May dawn. In this car sat the souls of Mr. In and Mr. Out, discussing with amazement the blue light that had so precipitately colored the sky behind the statue of Christopher Columbus, discussing with bewilderment the old gray faces of the early risers which skimmed palely along the street like blown bits of paper on a gray lake. They were agreed on all things, from the absurdity of the bouncers in Child's to the absurdity of the business of life. They were dizzy with the extreme maudlin happiness that the morning had awakened in their glowing souls. Indeed, so fresh and vigorous was their pleasure in living that they felt it should be expressed by loud cries.
"Yow!"
hooted Peter, making a megaphone with his hands, and Dean joined in with a call that, though equally significant and symbolic, derived its resonance from its very inarticulateness.
"Yo-ho! Yeah! Yo-ho! Yo-baba!"
53rd Street was a bus with a dark, bobbed-haired beauty atop. 52nd was a street cleaner who dodged, escaped, and sent up a yell of, "Look where you're aiming!" in a pained and grieved voice. At 50th Street, a group of men on a very white sidewalk in front of a very white building turned to stare after them and shouted,
"Some party, boys!"
At 49th, Peter turned to Dean.
"Beautiful morning,"
he said gravely, squinting up his owlish eyes.
"Probably is. Go get some breakfast, eh?"
Dean agreed, with additions.
"Breakfast and liquor."
"Breakfast and liquor," repeated Peter, and they looked at each other, nodding.
"That's logical."
Then they both burst into loud laughter.
"Breakfast and liquor! Oh, gosh!"
"No such thing," announced Peter.
"Don't serve it. Never mind. We force him serve it. Bring pressure, bear. Bring logic, bear."
The taxi cut suddenly off Broadway, sailed across a cross street, and stopped in front of a heavy, tomb-like building in Fifth Avenue.
"What's the idea?"
The taxi driver informed them that this was Delmonico's. This was somewhat puzzling. They were forced to devote several minutes to intense concentration, for if such an order had been given, there must have been a reason for it.
"Something about a coat," suggested the taxi man.
That was it. Peter's overcoat and hat. He had left them at Delmonico's. Having decided this, they disembarked from the taxi and strolled toward the entrance arm in arm.
"Hey,"
said the taxi driver.
"Huh? You better pay me."
They shook their heads in shocked negation.
"Later. Not now. We give orders. You wait."
The taxi driver objected. He wanted his money now. With the scornful condescension of men exercising tremendous self-control, they paid him. Inside, Peter groped in vain through a dim, deserted checkroom in search of his coat and derby.
"Gone, I guess. Somebody stole it."
"Some chef student."
"All probability."
"Ah, never mind,"
said Dean, nobly.
"I'll leave mine here, too. Then we'll both be dressed the same."
He removed his overcoat and hat and was hanging them up when his roving glance was caught and held magnetically by two large squares of cardboard tacked to the two coatroom doors. The one on the left-hand door bore the word "In" in big black letters, and the one on the right-hand door flaunted the equally emphatic word "Out."
"Look!"
he exclaimed happily. Peter's eyes followed his pointing finger.
"What?" "Look at the signs. Let's take 'em."
"Good idea. Probably a pair of very rare and valuable signs. Probably come in handy." Peter removed the left-hand sign from the door and endeavored to conceal it about his person. The sign being of considerable proportions, this was a matter of some difficulty. An idea flung itself at him, and with an air of dignified mystery, he turned his back. After an instant, he wheeled dramatically around and, stretching out his arms, displayed himself to the admiring dean. He had inserted the sign in his vest, completely covering his shirt front. In effect, the word "in" had been painted upon his shirt in large black letters.
"Yo-ho!" cheered Dean. "Mr. In."
He inserted his own sign in like manner.
"Mr. Out,"
he announced triumphantly.
"Mr. In, meet Mr. Out."
They advanced and shook hands. Again, laughter overcame them, and they rocked in a shaken spasm of mirth.
"Yo-ho! We probably get a flock of breakfast. We'll go to the Commodore."
Arm in arm, they sallied out the door, and turning east in 44th Street, set out for the Commodore. As they came out, a short, dark soldier, very pale and tired, who had been wandering listlessly along the sidewalk, turned to look at them. He started over as though to address them, but as they immediately bent on him glances of withering unrecognition, he waited until they had started unsteadily down the street, and then followed at about 40 paces, chuckling to himself and saying, "Oh, boy!" over and over under his breath in delighted, anticipatory tones. Mr. In and Mr. Out were meanwhile exchanging pleasantries concerning their future plans.
"We want liquor. We want breakfast."
Neither without the other, one and indivisible.
"We want both of 'em. Both of 'em."
It was quite light now, and passers-by began to bend curious eyes on the pair. Obviously, they were engaged in a discussion which afforded each of them intense amusement, for occasionally a fit of laughter would seize upon them so violently that, still with their arms interlocked, they would bend nearly double. Reaching the Commodore, they exchanged a few spicy epigrams with the sleepy-eyed doorman, navigated the revolving door with some difficulty, and then made their way through a thinly populated but startled lobby to the dining room, where a puzzled waiter showed them an obscure table in a corner. They studied the bill of fare helplessly, telling over the items to each other in puzzled mumbles.
"Don't see any liquor here," said Peter reproachfully.
The waiter became audible but unintelligible.
"Repeat," continued Peter, with patient tolerance, "that there seems to be unexplained and quite distasteful lack of liquor upon the bill of fare." "Here," said Dean confidently. "Let me handle him."
He turned to the waiter.
Bring us,
he scanned the bill of fare anxiously.
"Bring us a quart of champagne. And, probably ham sandwich."
The waiter looked doubtful.
"Bring it!"
roared Mr. In and Mr. Out in chorus. The waiter coughed and disappeared. There was a short wait, during which they were subjected, without their knowledge, to a careful scrutiny by the head waiter. Then the champagne arrived, and at the sight of it Mr. In and Mr. Out became jubilant.
"Imagine! They're objecting to us having champagne for breakfast. Just imagine!"
They both concentrated upon the vision of such an awesome possibility, but the feat was too much for them. It was impossible for their joint imaginations to conjure up a world where anyone might object anyone else having champagne for breakfast. The waiter drew the cork with an enormous pop, and their glasses immediately foamed with pale yellow froth.
"Here's health, Mr. In." "Here's same to you, Mr. Out."
The waiter withdrew. The minutes passed. The champagne became low in the bottle.
It's mortifying," said Dean suddenly. "What's mortifying? The idea. They're objecting to us having champagne breakfast."
"Mortifying?" Peter considered.
"Yes, that's a word, mortifying."
Again they collapsed into laughter, howled, swayed, rocked back and forth in their chairs, repeating the word mortifying over and over to each other, each repetition seeming to make it only more brilliantly absurd. After a few more gorgeous minutes, they decided on another quart. Their anxious waiter consulted his immediate superior, and this discreet person gave implicit instructions that no more champagne should be served. their check was brought. 5 minutes later, arm in arm, they left the Commodore and made their way through a curious, staring crowd along 42nd Street and up Vanderbilt Avenue to the Biltmore. There, with sudden cunning, they rose to the occasion and traversed the lobby, walking fast and standing unnaturally erect. Once in the dining room, they repeated their performance. They were torn between intermittent, convulsive laughter and sudden spasmodic discussions of politics, college, and the sunny state of their dispositions. Their watches told them that it was now 9 o'clock, and a dim idea was born in them that they were on a memorable party, something that they would remember always. They lingered over the second bottle. Either of them had only to mention the word mortifying to send them both into riotous gasps. The dining room was whirring and shifting now. A curious lightness permeated and rarefied the heavy air. They paid their check and walked out into the lobby. It was at this moment that the exterior doors revolved for the 1,000th time that morning and admitted into the lobby a very pale young beauty with dark circles under her eyes, attired in a much rumpled evening dress. She was accompanied by a plain, stout man, obviously not an appropriate escort. At the top of the stairs, this couple encountered Mr. In and Mr. Out. "Edith!" began Mr. In, stepping toward her hilariously and making a sweeping bow. "Darling, good morning!" The stout man glanced questioningly at Edith, as if merely asking her permission to throw this man summarily out of the way.
"Excuse familiarity," added Peter, as an afterthought. "Edith, good morning."
He seized Dean's elbow and impelled him into the foreground.
"Meet Mr. In, Edith, my best friend. Inseparable. Mr. In and Mr. Out."
Mr. Out advanced and bowed. In fact, he advanced so far and bowed so low that he tipped slightly forward and only kept his balance by placing a hand lightly on Edith's shoulder.
"I'm Mr. Out, Edith,"
he mumbled pleasantly.
"'S Mr. and Mr. Out. "'S Mr. In and Out,"
said Peter proudly. But Edith stared straight by them, her eyes fixed on some infinite speck in the gallery above her. She nodded slightly to the stout man, who advanced bull-like and with a sturdy, brisk gesture pushed Mr. In and Mr. Out to either side. Through this alley he and Edith walked. But 10 paces farther on, Edith stopped again, stopped and pointed to a short, dark soldier who was eyeing the crowd in general, and the tableau of Mr. In and Mr. Out in particular, with a sort of puzzled, spellbound awe.
"There!" cried Edith. "See there!"
Her voice rose, became somewhat shrill. Her pointing finger shook slightly.
"There's the soldier who broke my brother's leg!"
There were a dozen exclamations. A man in a cutaway coat left his place near the desk and advanced alertly. The stout person made a sort of lightning-like spring toward the short, dark soldier, and then the lobby closed around the little group and blotted them from the sight of Mr. In and Mr. Out. But to Mr. In and Mr. Out, this event was merely a parti-colored, iridescent segment of a whirring, spinning world. They heard loud voices. They saw the stout man spring. The picture suddenly blurred. Then they were in an elevator bound skyward.
"What floor, please?"
said the elevator man.
"Any floor,"
said Mr. In.
"Top floor,"
said Mr. Out.
"This is the top floor,"
said the elevator man.
"Have another floor put on,"
said Mr. Out.
"Higher,"
said Mr. In.
"Heaven,"
said Mr. Out. The end of Chapter 10 of May Day, as originally published in Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.